Okay, so you might know that there's an event coming up fairly soon, in a few weeks' time. You know, it's the big C word about that. So we're about to enter into the Christmas season, aren't we? And did anybody not know? So you're looking around there, Steve, looking like that was a surprise to you, mate, that it's Christmas soon.
The new Cuthbert baby.
Oh, no, you didn't. Well, that's a much more important event, isn't it? Eh? Yeah, much more significant. Sorry?
It's
going to
take 7 weeks
to travel. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But actually, we thought, I don't know if you, sometimes we call that the Advent, don't we? The Christmas season. And so we thought that actually maybe it might be helpful when we were planning this year. We thought it maybe be good to just have a, before we think about the first Advent, i.e. the coming of Jesus as a little baby, meek and mild and all that lovely. And that maybe we might want to think as well about the second, what's sometimes called the second Advent. Normally we would call it the second coming, wouldn't we? The second coming of Jesus. And I'll unpack that. If that's some of this sort of language is not too familiar with you, I will do my best this morning to try and make it as straightforward as I can. So Christians... generally, sort of Christians believe, or one of the sort of things that we believe from the Bible is that although Jesus came first time as a baby, and we celebrate that in Christmas, that we also believe that he is going to come again at some point in history, and we call that the second coming. And after that second coming, there will be a judgment, and then we'll all decide where we're going to actually, and then God will be sort of deciding where we're going to be in terms of eternity. And now that's the real simple, very, very, very simplified thing, and we'll come back to that in just a moment. But I'd be interested if, I'd be interested to sort of think that if I sort of start talking, and sorry, I'm going to do this over a few weeks, and so today I'm just going to try and just get us into thinking about some of these things, okay, and introducing it. And then we're going to start to look at a passage of Scripture, Matthew 24 and 25, okay? So we're going to look into in that a little bit, okay, so in a moment. But I'd be interested, actually, if you're a Christian here today, or maybe you're not Christian, or you're new to the Christian faith or whatever, and people start talking about the second coming, or they start talking more to the point about the end times, because that's another way we might think about this, the end times. I wonder sort of, one, what sort of imagery fills your mind? You know, wonder what sort of thoughts, and if I was to say to you, where in the Bible do you start, your mind immediately go to? I wonder where it would be. Anybody want to volunteer? Revelation, yeah, almost straight away. Most people would say we go to the book of, I don't know who said that, but it was a nice deep voice from over there somewhere. Revelation, or another Bible book. Daniel, yeah. So we probably would go the book of Revelation, or we'd go Daniel, or we would go perhaps to Peter, or Zechariah is one of the other ones. So all the big imagery things, isn't it? And I suppose really when we start thinking about the second coming and or the end times, that's normally our sort of starting place. I'm going to sort of suggest, with my sort of, we're going to dig into a few big words here today as well, but my sort of Christocentric hermeneutic, do you like that one? It's good for Scrabble. Basically, which means a Christ-centered approach to interpreting the Bible. That's basically what that means. I should have just said that to start with, really, shouldn't I? It's a bit easier. Yeah, so a Jesus-centered approach. I always think it's helpful to, personally, I think it's essential to always think, does Jesus have something definitive to say on the subject that we're looking at, whatever subject we're studying from the Scriptures? Is there a sense in which we can go back to the words of Jesus and begin there? And for me, Jesus, I think, unpacks this most powerfully in Matthew 24 and 25. And so that's where we're going to start. And I would suggest to you that even you see the same pattern of Matthew 24 and 25 in the book of Revelation. We should view Revelation through the lens of Matthew 24 and 25, I would suggest, and all the other bits and pieces in there. And then there's all these other big words that we use, isn't there? Some of the big scary words, like apocalypse. you use the word apocalypse and really scary, And then they make great movies about apocalypse now, don't they? But actually, apocalypse just means unveiling. And part of our belief system in the second coming is it's the unveiling of Christ. We'll see him who he is, the unveiling of history. Or rapture, that's another one which doesn't sound very nice, does it really? Who knows what the rapture is? That's it, yeah. So we'll get taken up into the air is another word. Or eschatology, that's a big one. You know, and that's, I'm just throwing these words out there because this is the sort of package that we put this in, all these great big words. You know, eschatology is our belief, our doctrine, our belief, our teaching around the second coming and the end time. So the whole thing sort of fits in that package. Or any other big words that you think you get with this end time thinking, second coming, sorry? Millennium. Yeah, that's a big one, isn't it? The idea of a thousand-year reign of Christ, whether that's actually a literal thousand years or whether we're living in the church ages, that, you know, is another one. So there's lots of things that are around, you know. So it's quite a complicated area. And when I first became a Christian, I remember sort of hearing people talking about all this stuff, you know, millennium, and they talk about premillennialism, yeah, forgive me, or post-millennial thinking, or amillennial thinking, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, they sound really serious about this, but I ain't got a clue what they're talking about, and it all seems very, very important, and you know, it does feel sort of, and as well, I think certainly the early Pentecostal movement, certainly they seem to really get stuck into this sort of end-time thinking, and lots of people had their own different opinions about or how all this stuff happened. So anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. Next, if that's all right. Can we go? Brilliant. I like this little quote, actually, just to sort of create a bit of a context from C.S. Lewis. If you read history, you will find that the Christians who did the most for the present world were just those who thought the most. It is since Christians have actually ceased to think of the other world that they have become ineffective in this. Aim at heaven and you will get earth thrown in. Aim at earth and you will get neither. And I found that quite a good thought, really, to sort of begin our journey today, really. Next week we'll think a little bit more about what heaven is about and what is heaven like and those sorts of thoughts. But if we just frame our thinking as Christians to do with what's happening in this life, then I think we miss out something. If all we're thinking about is the life to come and we're not being particularly much good in this, you know, then again, that's equally not as helpful, I would suggest, really. Next, if we can go to the next one. So, this is where I was beginning to get to, and I was waffling around just now about different big words and stuff. See, the basics, I would suggest to you, when we start thinking about the second coming and the return of Jesus, is this, that we are currently living in what's called the church age. So the church age is from the time of Jesus until the time that Jesus came, died, and then ascended to heaven, rose and went back to heaven, and up until the time that he will come again, we'd call that the church age, okay? And that in this particular age, heaven and earth experientially are separated, aren't they? You might sometimes think that you're in heaven when, I don't know, get some silly examples, but sometimes we could think, but actually there is that practical. Second coming of Jesus happens, and after that there will be final judgment, and there's just loads of theories about how that particular bit works, okay? And I'm not going to treat you to an engagement with those thoughts today, okay? We've already started to talk about that. Some people believe that there's going to be a thousand-year reign of Christ at some point, that, you know, either we will, as Christians, all leave before that or after it. Some people believe that we're living in that figurative thousand-year reign of Christ, and that the whole church age is that, is that language. People believe there will be a really terrible tribulation, really terrible times on earth just before Jesus returns. Other people would say, I think probably myself would say that, you know, this world is full of tribulation, full stop. And, you know, we're already in that, really, and that life is just like that. And sometimes it gets worse, sometimes it doesn't. And maybe it is going to get a little bit worse before Jesus returns. But so there's just loads of different theories about how all that works. But it seems to me that it's sad that I think that we put so much effort into some of that stuff sometimes, when that is just going to happen as it happens. You and I are not going to have a lot of influence over the way that God chooses to put that whole package together. And maybe it's not the best use of our brain time to spend too much time on that. And then after that, basically the end of the whole thing is that we're either with God in heaven. If you're a Christian, then you will go to be with God. The dwelling place of God is with men and women, we're told in the end of in Book of Revelation, and so we'll be together, or we will be separated from God. And the image of that is the lake of fire at the end. That I think many of you know me would know that I don't believe that in conscious eternal punishment, i.e., the idea that that hell means that we suffer in a fiery pit for all eternity. I don't think the Bible actually teaches that, but lots and lots of Christians do, and I guess many of you here would today. But you know, that's it, that would be the other alternative. Okay, if you're not a follower of Christ, you're not a follower of Jesus, then there will be an unpleasant experience after death. Whether that ends for all eternity, happens and carries on for all eternity, is another story for another day. Okay, so now I've scared you all, sorry. Let's move on to the next slide, if that's okay. Not the next one, one beyond that, actually, if that's okay. Not going to bore you with that one. Next. Brilliant, okay. And so, as I said really already, when we start thinking about this stuff, this second coming, this the end times, a lot of the imagery often is quite scary, and the thinking that we have around it is quite scary. And I want just to pause that thought for a little bit, and we're going to try and engage with things that Jesus had to say about this. You see, I think when Jesus taught about this in Matthew 24 and 25, and I really am just going to be quite simple with this today, and just I think this is quite a complicated passage of scripture or a couple of chapters of scripture. If you do hit the books on this stuff, if you did read some of the commentaries or some of the books that discuss this, then you'll see that some of it actually gets really quite complicated. There's some really big questions about what Jesus was talking about in some of the things that he says in that particular passage. And I'm going to choose to sort of try and be a little bit more simple, if that's okay. I think Jesus puts this into essentially five blocks of teaching within this. So it begins, the whole thing begins with Jesus offering some quite distressing statements, okay? Some things that are really quite upsetting to his disciples. And off the back of that, they ask him three questions. And I suggest to you that those questions are the questions that we have been asking for the last 2,000 years. Questions that generally where we want to go when we think about this whole sort of idea of Jesus returning and second coming. All that. Jesus then replies to their questions to some degree, okay? He answers their questions a little bit. But off the back of that, he then goes on to talk about some things that he wants to say. Because Jesus is a bit annoying like that sometimes. You ask him about something, and his response is to say, well, this is the answer, but actually, I really want to talk to you about this. And that's basically what he does to these guys, you know. He says to them, okay, you want to know about these things, but actually, I've got something else. I want to talk to you about you being ready for when I come back. I want to talk to you about how you get ready for when I come back. And then he says, I want to talk to you about how you are going to be judged at that end judgment. I want to talk to you about the nature of the judgment, the things that God is looking for when he's assessing you in that. And I think that's what Jesus essentially wants to talk to them about. Is that okay? Great. Let's get into this then, shall we? And like I say, I'm not going to spend too long on this today, but we could spend a long time if we wanted to. Great. So next. That's okay? Thank you, sir. So Jesus offers these explosive comments. Beginning, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Matthew 24, we're just 23, we're just stepping back before 24 and putting it into context. Do you know, it's really interesting that this same sort of set of teaching appears both in Mark's Gospel and Luke's Gospel as well. In both Mark and Luke, the framework, the thing that comes just before this teaching is the widow giving the mite at the temple, the widow's mite, which is interesting. I'm sure there's some things for us to think about there as well, but we're not going to do that now. Okay. So, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing. Look, Matthew chooses to frame this teaching by letting us appreciate that it comes out of a time when Jesus comes to Jerusalem for the last time. And as he approaches Jerusalem, he uses the image of being like a mother hen who has her chicks underneath her arms and feels protective. And he chooses to show us that Jesus is distressed by what he's seen. He's distressed by the fact that God has consistently, over hundreds of years, been sending people to talk to this nation about how they can enjoy God's best, how they can live in the will of God in such a way that they would know a better life, and how consistently the nation has rejected God's appeals to follow him, God's appeals to be a just society, a kind society, how so often, again and again and again, they've rejected that. And Jesus walks into this particular moment, if you like, and Matthew helps us to appreciate teaching flows out of Jesus being distressed at the fact that a nation had not listened to the voice of God, and more than that, had then persecuted those who spoke for God. Now, isn't that interesting in itself? That this end time thinking of God, the second coming, the end time teaching that Jesus is going to frame for us here is born out of a moment in which Jesus expresses his distress at the way the world has rejected the heart and the voice of God. And that's still true now, isn't it, really? That so often, even as Christians, we reject the heart and the voice of God. You know, this is not just about some wacky prophet wanting to turn up and tell everybody what to do. This is about somebody who wanted to connect them with the heart of God. The prophetic voice, the prophetic ministry fundamentally flows out of a desire from God to connect us with his heart, with his passions, with his will, his way of doing things and being and existing. And Jesus saying, no, I feel really maternal about this. I feel maternal about you. I care about you. I have a deep love and passion for you. And so when we're thinking about this end time stuff and we see all these images that are thrown at us in the media and Christian press and all that sort of stuff, let's not slip into a thinking that the end times and the judgment is about an angry God being ticked off with the world and just wanting to come and belt us with a big stick. That is not where it all starts. It starts with a God who's like a mother hen with her chicks underneath her arm, wanting to give the best and protect from the bad weather, if you like. Could dwell on that thought all morning, couldn't we? Look, your house is left to you desolate, for I tell you that you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. He left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. Do you see all these things, he asked. Truly, I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. Do you know, it's hard to get our heads around just how devastating those words were for Jesus. Jesus was basically saying that Jerusalem was going to be desolated, their capital city. Jerusalem, the place that was the home of King David. The Jerusalem, the city that had housed the Ark of the Covenant. Jerusalem that had been the centre of all their hopes and dreams. And Jesus is saying, because you've rejected the prophets, because you've all these things, you know, your city is going to be desolated. And more than that, I'm going to go away for a while and I'm not going to be with you. Again, you know, you imagine you're on this journey with Jesus. You've been walking around with him for 2 years, seeing him heal the sick and raise the dead and put dignity back into people's lives and challenging religious nonsense and all those sorts of things. And he says, but actually, boys, I'm off now. I'm going in a little while. I don't know about you, but you'd feel a bit distressed, wouldn't you? You'd be thinking, I don't want you to go, you know. And then he says, this temple is going to be pulled down, and not one stone's going to be on top of another. The temple was the great symbol of their centrality of their faith, of the God of Israel choosing them and to be the demonstration of the religious life on the earth. And Jesus is saying, even that is going to go. It's hard for us to get our minds around just how devastating that would have been, how traumatic to them. You know, it'd be a little bit like somebody saying to you, next week, you know, or in a couple of weeks' time, London is going to be flattened. And the Houses of Parliament, you know, and they're going to be pulled down, and you know, there's going to be a foreign power invade London and take over the capital city and Buckingham Palace is going to be pulled down, and we would sort of think, you know, they are symbols of our national identity. They somehow are wrapped up with who we are. Probably not quite so much these days. Maybe for some of us, it would be like saying like football team or could never play again, okay, or the rugby team, so we won't go there, okay. Something like that, it would have been quite distressing to them. And so they reply, so Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came to him to call his attentions to its buildings. Do you see all these things? He asked, truly I tell you, not one stone will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately and they said, tell us, when will this happen and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Sorry, I should have said step onto the next one. Sorry, mate.
That's right.
You can go next. That's it, you've got it. Brilliant. Can you go to the next one for me as well? Yeah, great. So, it's interesting, the three things that they ask Jesus, they say, when will this happen? What will be the sign of your coming? So they've got their head around the idea that he's going, and the sign of the end of the age. I like this little quote by Martin Lloyd-Jones, the great preacher from years back. The great doctrine of the Second Advent has, in a sense, fallen into disrepute because of this tendency on the part of some to be more interested in the how and the when of the Second Coming rather in the fact of the Second Coming. See, I think the disciples' questions here go to the heart of the way that we often approach this thing. We want to know when will Jesus come back, don't we? I did a quick sort of Google search on dates that people have put when Jesus will return. There's loads of them. That's probably the heart. Some of these symbolisms are not easy to understand in Jesus' teaching. But I think the heart of what I'm trying to get at here, or I'd like to just, if you like, put out there in your thinking, is that what many people have sought to do over the years is to try and say Jesus will return on such and such a date. So, for instance, one pope said that Jesus would return 666 days after the launch of Islam or the birth of Muhammad. You know, there was people who said that Jesus would return after the first 1,000 years of the church because that was the first millennium. We've had people like the Jehovah's Witnesses saying that Jesus would return in 1917. He didn't turn up. It's a bit inconvenient. So then they picked another date. He still didn't turn up because he doesn't do those sorts of things, does he? You know, so now they say that he returned invisibly. And Jesus did return in 1917 and that it was an invisible return. We laugh, actually, but actually there are Christian people who say the same sorts of things. And so we want to put a date on it, don't we? You know, because you know, if you're going to have a party, you want to know when it's going to happen. If you're going to get married, you want to know the wedding date, don't you? You're going to do it. So Jesus, will you put a date on it? No, that's not very helpful, you know. And then we want to know exactly. Can we see the signs of when it's going to happen? And yeah, okay, we do get the Jesus creating these. I think those images of blood and fire and the moon and stuff are just ways of saying that bad, tough things are going to happen, you know. Whether that's a literal thing or not, I'm not sure. But the point I'm trying to get is that people ask, you know, we often want to know all the signs, but I'm not sure that Jesus actually plays that game with us. And so for 2,000 years, we've been asking when and how. And Jesus' response has been to say, well, I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to give you some clues in the signs, but actually what I really want you to do is to be ready for when I come back. Yeah. Be ready all the time. Be ready all the time. And that's not quite so easy, is it? You know, we get ourselves all ready to go out. You know, if you've got, I'm not going to do the thing, well, I'm doing it, aren't I, really? But, you know, you get yourself ready to go, and the other person is not ready yet. And you're ready downstairs trying to be as patient as you can, and in the end, you know, I'll have a cup of tea, you know, and not looking at anybody. But actually, I can be just as bad, actually. So, yeah, so it. And that seems to me to be the response that Jesus has. for us. So let's move on, shall we? Next. Is that okay? I hope I'm not trying to do too much here this morning, because I appreciate some of this stuff's a bit deep and heavy, and this is like more like on teaching stuff. But so what does Jesus do? Basically, he paints a picture. He paints the big picture. And if you used to read through 4 through 14, you'd see that he talks about there being wars and rumours of wars. There'll be earthquakes and famines and various places. And then in there, in the middle of that, he talks about the destruction of Jerusalem. And then he makes it clear that we can't be sure when he will return. So he offers two sort of big thoughts there. One is the destruction of Jerusalem will happen, and you will know when it's coming, and you can get ready for that. And the Christians survived the best, if you like, when the Romans sacked Jerusalem in AD 70. Many of them, when they saw the Romans coming, fled the city and survived, based on Jesus' words here. But when it comes to the second coming, he says, people will try and say that it's happening, but you know, you'll know when I return. There won't be any question about it. Okay, great. So, because time's running on, I'm just going to sort of, basically what I think he does is he offers us three warnings. So what I want to just try, there was a great book by a guy called J. Oswald Sanders years ago that was Certainties of Christ's Second Coming, okay? And so my general rule when I'm looking at difficult passages in the Bible is say, are there some bits that are a little bit simpler to see? And then start from them, and then we can work out onto the more difficult bits. And so I'm going to spend probably just 5 minutes now just suggesting to you that there are some more straightforward parts to this, if that's okay, and then we'll wrap it up. And I promise next week I won't be quite so heavy. I'll be a little bit more to the point. Is that all right? Yeah, great. Okay, next. So, Jesus offers, I would suggest, three warnings. Three times he says, don't be deceived. Now, isn't that interesting? Because this whole sort of end time thinking, this is wrapped up with so many spurious theories, aren't there? People saying that 666... is to do with credit cards and implants into your skin. Please don't. This cannot work that, I don't think. I can unpack that to you another time if you like, really, but it doesn't. Or that it's people having tattoos on the. It's just about being who you are identified with, because it's compared to the mark of, you know, to the mark of the beast with the mark of Christ, you know, those who are marked and sealed with the seal that Jesus. So Jesus says there will be two particular types of deception that will take place. One is to do with I am the Messiah. The other is to do with false prophets, i.e. some people who say, I am the person you should trust in. I'm the one that you should follow. Personality cults. People who wrap the faith up with who they are and almost replace Christ. False anointings. And the other is these false prophets. People who predict things that are not from the heart of God. Some of the prophetic stuff that I hear around that links itself to the second coming, I have to say to you, is just devoid of the heart and the passion of God, the life of God. Things that are so judgmental and harsh, difficult to resonate with. And then some of the interpretations that we get around this. I remember hearing one serious Bible teacher on one of the channels a little while ago, basically saying, comparing the oil fields being on fire to some of the sort of imagery that we get in the book of Revelation. Or they used to say that the tanks, Mussolini's tanks, were like the scorpions because of the fire that was coming out the back and stuff like this. You know, you can interpret the symbolism and the imagery prophetically in so many different ways. And Jesus is telling us, be careful. The point is that when we're thinking about listening to end time teaching, when we're engaging with what people are wanting to us to think about when it comes to, all I'm saying is that Jesus gave us a warning and said, be cautious, because there's lots of deception around this. If it sounds like nonsense, it probably is. If it sounds like it's come out of a loony theory, then it probably is a loony theory, yeah? So, next. I'm trying to achieve too much this morning. Next, no, we won't go there. Okay, that's one. A Trumpacopolis or whatever. That's a serious book somebody wrote a little while ago. Because actually, at the moment, there are theories awash, aren't there? We're in a world where China is on his new round. Some of the things that are happening in the States, they're, anyway, we'll come back to Next. That's okay. Next.
Yeah, sorry.
Come on, get on with it. That's all right. The next one he says is, don't be frightened. You'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. Such things see to it, you're not alarmed. There'll be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginnings of birth pains. And basically in the middle of that, he says, be careful. Because it's frightening, isn't it? People try to scare us with some of this imagery. And we live in a world that is, to be honest, it's horrible, isn't it? Many, many ways. And it's not saying, Jesus is not saying that don't be distressed by these things, but don't let them beat you. See, we can live in fear of what's happening in the world around us, can't we? And certainly, as we then start to interpret this, there was a, what was it, rapture? There was a hashtag, Twitter hashtag a little while ago. Trying to think what it was now. Oh, something like rapture distress. It was around when Trump moved the US embassy to Jerusalem. And lots of Christians then started to say that this is the starting of this second coming happening, and then people sort of, this hashtag arose of people posting how they had been left church or moved away from Christianity because they had been people had scared them with imagery that surrounded the second coming of Jesus, and so that they were meant to sort of live their lives in fear and trauma. So there is a thing about fear being around all this thing, isn't there? Next. That's okay. Next. I said, yeah. And then Jesus says, don't let your love grow cold. So three warnings that Jesus gives us in these passages, okay? One is, be careful you're not deceived. One is, don't let fear overcome you. And third is, don't let your love grow cold. And that's probably the biggest warning, isn't it? When we live in traumatic times, when difficult things are happening, it's so easy to sort of think, well, God, why are you letting this happen? And start backing away from God. Because of the increase of wickedness, love of many will grow cold. That's an interesting thought, isn't it? I'll leave you to chew on that, really. That we're checking our hearts. Jesus wants to know whether we're going to keep our passions alive. Next. And then some other things that you perhaps want us to get. He wanted us to know that we're meant to get this gospel of the kingdom out to the ends of the earth. Conscious of, I've probably tried to put too much into this morning. I'm sorry about this, folks, but I'm just going to wrap this. If you're right for just for a few more minutes, we probably won't have a song at the end. Is that okay? And then next week I'll get it into a bit more condensed form. Is that right? I think I've just tried to cover too much ground. Okay, so Jesus says here that this gospel of the kingdom must be preached to the whole world, and then the end will come. And so in this thing of thinking about the end times, there is a commitment that God in us must be committing in us to get this gospel out. In actual fact, he says this gospel will be preached to all ethnos. The Greek word is ethnic, ethnos. So every people group, every tribe, every type of person. And it's not just the gospel in the sense that we throw a few words at people. It's this gospel of the kingdom. The kingdom that cheeks the life of God, the express life of God. The kingdom that when we pray, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And so when we're taking this life of heaven to the ends of the earth, then Jesus is saying he will come. And so it seems to me that Jesus is saying that this God is going to restrain the second coming of Jesus until every type of person throughout this earth has opportunity to respond to the life of God that is expressed in his kingdom gospel. That's interesting in itself, isn't it? And when we're talking about tribes, we're not just talking about people, you know, those that live in the back end of Papua New Guinea or somewhere. You're talking about culture tribes as well, aren't we? Type of people groups that we sometimes think, oh, well, no, God could never touch them, or they're a bit too scary. To every type of tribe as God has. And so I suppose in that sense, that we're being told that we are meant to engage with the world in which we live, and that our end time beliefs should not cause us to withdraw from the world in which we live. There's a church leader that I knew a few years back from down in Romford Way, and he's now, with a whole group of his leadership, basically moved up north, bought a farm, and they are preparing for the end time persecution, and sort of like cut themselves off from the world and just got this little haven. I think that's loony, if I'm honest with you. That's the sort of thing we're talking about. And for some people, this end time, when they get engaged with end time thinking, it causes them to step back and disengage with this world. Where Jesus is saying, actually, if you want me to come back, you've got to engage with this world and get this gospel of the kingdom out to the ends of the earth. And then he's saying, and then if we was to read on into the parables that then Jesus tells, because he goes from, okay, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about distressing things that are going to happen in the world and all that sort of stuff, but actually, I want to tell you some parables, some stories. He tells them a story about a master who's going to go and who leaves his servant in charge of the other servants. And basically, when the king comes back, the master comes back, he wants to see whether he's been looking after the other servants. And then equally, he tells another one about how the parable of the 10 virgins and then the parable of the talents. And the parable of the, and then the story of the sheep and the goats. And inherent in all three of those parables is the idea that the king or the master is going to take a long time in coming back. See, each generation has lived with this idea that Jesus is going to return now. And I think we should. I think we should live with a passion to see Jesus return in our lifetime. But actually, Jesus built into the fabric of his teaching here the thought that it's going to be longer than we think. And we're going to be finding ourselves thinking, well, he ain't coming, so I'll just take advantage of the situation. He's not coming, I'll just take it easy. He's not coming, you know. Or he's a bit of a scary guy, so I don't think I'll really use what he's used. It's built into this, is the idea that. And so our end time teaching should not stop us planning for the future. You know, I've heard of people who maxed out their credit card because they thought Jesus was coming back in the next couple of years. Serious stuff. Racked up huge debts just because they think, well, I won't have to pay them off because Jesus will be coming back. Selling their houses. Other people have just given away everything, you know, thinking, they're not, what's the point? I'll just live on the proceeds of the... You know, these are serious things that people have done over the years. Next, and we'll finish with this. And then in the middle of all this, Jesus says, I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. Again, not necessarily an easy passage of scripture, but in the heart of all the things that Jesus is talking about, he says to us, listen, you need to realize that all the way this is all going to work is not, humanity will not self-destruct itself. God will put limits on this thing. And for us as Christians, as we think about the end times, as we think about when will Jesus return, we do have to live in this world, don't we? We do have to evaluate how we live, read the signs of the times. But ultimately, it is in God's hands. Heaven and earth might pass away, but the words of Jesus won't. And so for us as Christians, we should live with a sense of confidence in the life of Christ. Live in confidence that Jesus is our security and that this stuff will not overtake us, and that God will make sure that he ultimately is in charge. I'm not keen on the whole sovereignty conversation where people say, oh, well, you know, at the end of the day, God's in charge. Of course he's in charge. But we still have a role to play. We still have to be part of what happens. Okay. Time's gone. Should we pray together just for a moment? There is a handout on the welcome desk, and if you want to take one of those, there's a lot more sort of stuff in there you can have a look about. I've covered far too much ground this morning, but hopefully what we've done is we've engaged with some of the thinking that Jesus wants to offer us when it comes to thinking about end times. Okay. Thank you, Lord. Can I just ask you, whilst we've got our heads bowed or we're in an attitude of prayer, if you found yourself thinking the end time conversation scares you or causes you to want to back away from God while you're sitting, to help you with that.